Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Yasmin Khan, a reporter here at KUNM. Voting rights are the bedrock of American democracy, yet for many people, that right is not a reality. Voter suppression has a long history in the United States and has largely affected people of color and women. On today's show, we focus on the white supremacist roots of voter suppression and how they affect the upcoming COVID-impacted election. We will explore felon voter laws and the fragile history of voting rights for Black people and Native Americans. And we want to hear from you. Have you or a loved one been denied your right to vote? Are you worried about how you're going to cast your vote this fall? Join the conversation by emailing letstalk@kunm.org or call into the show at 277-5866. I want to welcome Dr. Finney Coleman to the show. Dr. Coleman teaches at UNM in Africana Studies and the Department of English Language and Literatures. He has taught hip-hop culture, Black Lives Matter, and this fall an experimental course titled Afrofuturism, Black Superheroes and the Public Image of Blackness. The Black Lives Matter uprising around the world continues the civil rights movement from the 1960s and is centered on recognizing the toll of police violence on Black bodies. But the BLM uprising also pushes us to examine wider structural racism that Black and brown communities are constantly battling. And one of those structures is our voting system. Finney, can you start us off with a brief history of the roots of anti-Black voter suppression and how it's affecting our democracy today?
Of course. Good morning, everyone. You know, it's important for us to understand the 13th Amendment if we're going to understand the entirety of this history. And that in the 13th Amendment, slavery was allowed to continue under the guise of incarceration so that a person could go to jail and still remain enslaved. And in the South, there are many efforts made to keep people who had been held as slaves in that condition after the Emancipation Proclamation, after the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments to the Constitution. Of course, the 15th giving people the franchise, giving Black men the franchise. And so the white primaries actually didn't come around until the 1896 presidential election. We didn't see those until then. There were any number of strategies that were put in place. Most people understand them as tactics like grandfather clauses and poll taxes and the like. They were all used to disenfranchise Black voters. In 1896, it became pretty clear that these all-white primaries would be a good strategy. By the 1902 election, you're seeing them spreading across the South, the midterm 1902 elections. But the root of how Black people lost their right to vote, if you look at the percentages today, Black people make up 13.4% of the population. But they make up 38% of people who are disenfranchised voters in America. This was a strategy that worked. And once we arrived at this, prison convict lease system, it's baked into who we were post Reconstruction America.
And to be clear, Finney, the white primary, just for people who don't know, was thought up in South Carolina and was where, although Black people and women had the right to vote, only white, mostly white men voted in the primaries, so that people who were not white then got to vote after white people chose the candidates. And there is some critique that we've come back to the white primary in the way that Iowa and New Hampshire, states that have 91 and 93% white voters, are such important states in the primaries. So there is some critique of we're going back to this white primary. So just to clarify what the white primary is, and maybe you could say a few words on the grandfather clause too.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's no coincidence that we then moved directly from Iowa into New Hampshire. So, when we look at who has the right to vote, the blacker a state is, the more harsh the voting laws are. In terms of the darker the population, people in New Hampshire and I believe in Vermont are actually allowed to vote in jail. Those states are almost all white, those prison populations. So this is not accidental, and it's not. So the grandfather clauses, we tend to think about them as a preventative, something that prevented black voters from voting. It actually works a little bit differently than that. What the grandfather clauses did, they kept the laws on the books, the rules on the books for everyone, but people who were grandfathered in were actually white people. So white people who could not pay a poll tax, white people who could not pass a literacy test, white people who could not, who if those rules were put in place, would not be able to vote. That's where the grandfather clause came from. It wasn't if your grandfather couldn't vote, you couldn't vote. It was if you were exempt from these rules if your grandfather voted. And so if your grandfather hadn't voted as a black person, it meant that you were susceptible to whatever the rules were. You had to pass these remarkable tests in order to exercise the franchise.
Mm. And you mentioned, so I want to get into that, one of the biggest voter disenfranchisement mechanisms that deeply impact communities of color is taking away the right to vote from people with felony convictions, which is the law, like you said, in all but two states, different variations of this law. Black, Latino, and Native populations are disproportionately represented in incarcerated populations, contributing to a nationwide voting rights crisis in which over 5 million Americans, the majority of whom are people of color, cannot vote due to felony conviction. And an expert on this I want to welcome to the show is Justin Allen, an American Studies undergraduate at UNM and an intern at America Votes. And Justin is focused on restorative justice practices such as reducing recidivism, harm reduction, and advocacy for incarcerated people. Justin, thank you for joining us. You've done quite a bit of research on the white supremacist roots of voter suppression in the United States. What have you learned about how this history has affected New Mexican voters?
Well, I've learned that the history of disenfranchisement looks a little bit different in New Mexico than it does in southern states. I researched the history of disenfranchisement, and I found that the phrase "Indians not taxed" was frequently used in state constitutions and statutes to exclude Native Americans from voting, and is founded in our U.S. Constitution. It has been used as economic argument that Native Americans should not be permitted to vote or participate in revenue decisions, for example, bond elections, because they do not pay taxes. Additionally, some states have maintained that if the state government has no taxing power over reservations, then Native Americans should not be able to participate in the election of state officials. In 1940, New Mexico was one of the five states that still prohibited Native Americans not taxed from voting, even though they had granted the franchise to whites who were not taxed. The Jim Crow era was the beginning of patchwork of state felony disenfranchisement laws, which vary in severity from state to state. An estimated 6.1 million Americans are prohibited from voting due to laws that disenfranchise citizens convicted of felonies. New Mexico incarcerates Latinos at a higher percentage than other states in the country, and Black and Native populations are also disproportionately overrepresented in the New Mexico criminal punishment system. Racial disparities in our justice system demonstrate how restoring the vote to people of color with felony convictions would take a step towards reversing the racist Jim Crow laws of the past.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see these laws of this election for many people, for the whole country, is a very important election. What's at stake if we don't really uncover the roots of these laws here in New Mexico?
What's at stake is the continued systemic racism, institutional racism. We only have a two-party system to choose from right now, and that's because the two-party system relies on entire populations of people rendering their bodies silent in order to sustain one another. I'm a firm believer that if formerly incarcerated people were given the opportunity to participate as citizens, we eventually become productive members.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask listeners, why is voting important to you? Have you ever had trouble registering to vote or getting a ballot? We want to hear from you. Our phone lines are open. Call 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. And we also have New Mexico Democratic State Senator Daniel Ivy Soto on the line, currently serving as Executive Director for County Clerks. He's a former state elections director, prosecutor, and teacher. Thank you so much for being on the show, Senator.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Senator, you've done several years of work with voter rights in New Mexico. According to Human Rights Watch, no country strips voting rights from a larger proportion of its citizens than the United States. What does this mean for the people of this country and for New Mexicans?
You know, the history of voting rights in this country and in our state is really, in many ways, the history of how do we enfranchise people. It is a history of undoing disempowerment that happened at the very inception of our country, and in fact, that's the whole reason why we have voter registration. We register people to vote not in order to include them in the voting process. We register people to vote because that way, everybody else is properly excluded from the voting process. You know, in New Mexico, our state constitution, when we first became a state, the language dealing with voting rights said the following. Every male citizen of the United States, well, that doesn't apply anymore. Who's over the age of 21 years, well, that doesn't apply anymore. Has resided in New Mexico for 12 months. That doesn't apply. In the county, 90 days. Nor does that. In the precinct in which he offers to vote, 30 days. Well, we now have same-day registration during early voting. Next preceded the election. Except, so those people who can vote, except idiots, insane persons, persons convicted of a felonious or infamous crime unless restored to political rights, and Indians not taxed. So those people can't vote. The other ones within that previous category shall be qualified to vote in all elections for public officers. Now, when you listen to that, you hear all of the exclusions that are happening. I mean, you have to stop and ask yourself, what's left? When it comes to the issue of women voting, our state constitution set aside it provided that all school elections shall be held at different times from other elections. Why would we have done that in our Constitution under the Voting Rights Clause? Because our Constitution went on to say women possessing the qualifications prescribed in this section for male electors shall be qualified electors at such school elections. Because, you know, I guess they decided women understand children, so they should be able to vote on those issues. Mm. But then they went on. Provided that if a majority of the qualified voters of any school district, now that's back to the men again, not less than 30 days before any school election, present a petition to the Board of County Commissioners against women's suffrage in such district, the provision of this section related to women's suffrage shall be suspended, and the provision shall again be operative only upon filing with said board of a petition signed by majority of the qualified electors, men again, favoring the restoration thereof. I mean, that's pretty harsh, and that was put in a section of our Constitution that required 2/3 of the voters of every county and 3/4 of the voters of the entire state in order to amend. That language that I read remained in our Constitution until 1967. Wow. Even though, because of we're celebrating the centennial of the 19th Amendment in 1920, women had universal suffrage. As of 1948, Native Americans were allowed to vote, but that language remained there, and the idiots and insane persons language and the language restricting felons, which was very similar to the language used in Florida that everybody has been talking about lately as one of the most egregious in the country, that remained in our Constitution until September 21st, 2016.
Wow. Wow. Thank you for that, Senator. We have to go to a quick break, but we're going to get right back to this. If you want to join the conversation about voter suppression and voting challenges in New Mexico, give us a call at 277-5866. You can also tweet to us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be back in a minute.
This piece by Maurice Ravel is an artful reflection of the uncertainty and anxiety that was heavy in the air after World War I, which in some ways also feels like a reflection of our times. We'll hear the beauty, the whimsy, and the unraveling of La Valse by Maurice Ravel on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Hi, my name is Katie Huska. I support, love, need KUNM because it to me, it is like the most community-oriented media format in my life. And the scope of programming for me is perfect. The variety, I listen to almost all of the programs, and I appreciate them all. So keep it up. Thanks very much for asking for my opinion.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Yasmin Khan. This morning, we're talking about the white supremacist roots of voter suppression in the U.S. and how these challenges disproportionately affect Black and brown voters. Have you had challenges accessing the polls or getting registered to vote? Do you or someone you know want to vote in the 2020 general election but can't? Give us a call at 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. Now we have a caller, Nomi, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi. I haven't had a difficulty voting to the best of my knowledge, but I am curious because historically this suppression that happens on all different levels systemically, I think has like sort of rooted itself in the subconscious of people of color and voting. And so my concern is with all of this that has historically happened that is currently still problematic, how does one motivate other people of color to even vote when you anticipate, some kind of possible suppression or injustice happening? So I'll take my answer off the air.
No, that's true. A lot of people will feel that suppression as they are at the polls. Finney, can you comment on this idea of how to get more people of color and other people who maybe have faced suppression, people that don't have IDs or people that might be in rural areas? How do we get people to get out and vote?
I mean, it's a very difficult question, and I don't think that the answer to that is specific to the Black community or people of color. There are restrictions and things in place that, prevent, essentially try to make sure that we stay as close to our historical roots, white male property owners who vote. I was on the phone just last night with a friend of mine in Alabama who is going to today's his birthday, but he isn't taking today off. He is going to take Election Day off, though, because otherwise there's a good chance that he would not get a chance to cast his vote. And so, rather than using his vacation time for, his birthday, he's going to use that time so he can get to the polls to vote. So, some of this have to be self-motivated. I think we have to encourage people at every turn to get out to vote. I think there's sometimes a misperception that people of color are apathetic and will not vote or the like. Nothing could be further from the truth, actually. It's that those people typically face far more barriers to exercising the franchise than others. When you see these long lines at polls and places like Cleveland, Ohio, and the like, when you look at the demographics in those lines, almost always those are people of color, almost always majority, largely people of color, because the conditions that, in an urban environment or a rural environment, being able to get off from work and then go to the polls, we would have much higher turnout if some of the institutional barriers to voting, like having voting on a Saturday as opposed to on a Tuesday. We hold to that Tuesday election day largely because the people who are in power realize that not everyone's going to be able to get out and vote on a Tuesday. And I know there'll be the traditionalists who will argue with me about that, but we've changed all kinds of holidays and the like in our country. If we truly wanted people to vote, we would make it a national holiday, or we would move it to a Saturday. And as a nation, we just simply don't want to do that. Black people, Native Americans, Latinos, as a group, face far more barriers, and therefore it's much more difficult for them to get to the polls. But we have to do everything that we can to encourage people to go to the polls. We have to take people to the polls themselves. We have to help people get registered. We have to actually work hard against the set of barriers that are in front of people, keeping them from voting.
Mm-hmm. And to just expand on this point, when we, in the larger scheme of things, when we start at voting as like this point of civic participation, but when people of color, when black voters, when brown voters, when Native American voters are disenfranchised, how does that reality affect civic participation? How does it affect everyone as a whole? And what does it mean for the future of our state?
You know, I think when we look at, I tend to focus on the numbers in the black community and how those numbers and why they are what they are. And what we have to look at is what happens to people after they get out of prison as well. And when you look at places like Florida and Mississippi, Kentucky, Georgia, those places have very high percentages of people who are in some kind of post-sentence arrangement with the state. They're on probation, felony probation, or they're on parole. And in those, and so what you do is you have people of color. We're going to release you early, we're going to put you on parole, right? Or we're going to put you in some kind of process, and that keeps you from having that right to vote. And so what looks like on the one hand, not a benefit, but something that isn't going to harm you, in the end, it does. It takes away the franchise from you. So, that's a very difficult question. I think it's I know, Daniel, you looked like you were going to weigh in on that. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just going to comment about and you know, I think the institutional structure of what we do that participates in that disenfranchisement that Dr. Coleman was bringing up, I think is something we all need to be very much aware of. But the impact of people not voting is that their perspective isn't listened to. Think about voting as the original crowdsourcing. We recognize in this day of the internet the wisdom of the crowd of crowdsourcing something in order to get a better answer, in order to get a better development of something. And voting really is the original crowdsourcing of an idea or of who should be in leadership. The problem is, while we have, I think, pretty much always in this country, except for maybe the current occupant of the White House, very much it's been sacrosanct to us to respect the result of what comes out of the ballot box. But we've never been quite so careful about what goes into the ballot box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Justin, this is basically what you're focusing on for your research, for your work. What's coming up for you in this conversation? What do you think of what's the reality for our state when people don't get to vote?
Well, the reality is that right now, ending disenfranchisement would mean that over 24,000 people in New Mexico with felony convictions would become eligible. Not everybody who has come out of prison is going to be interested in politics. I wasn't interested in politics just because many of us believe that the system, we're reluctant of a system that has enforced laws and taken our voice away. I think getting marginalized populations to vote would involve validating the voices of the most marginalized, political education, and the opportunity for civic engagement. One of the barriers I see is, you know, disenfranchisement reinforces that code of silence that people assimilate to upon entering the prison industrial complex. Most people who have found themselves in prison lost their voice long before they ended up there. That's why we allow others to make decisions about us. That's why we accept plea bargains. So a lot of it has to do with self-esteem and just distrust of the entire system. We need more education for people that have been disenfranchised so that they can understand why it's necessary.
I would like to thank Dr. Finney Coleman, for joining us today. Thank you so much for your insight. And I would like to welcome Kelly Garcia Chavez to the show. Kelly is a community organizer and member of the Justice Advisory Board with the ACLU New Mexico. She works with marginalized communities pushing for voting rights. Thank you for being here, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I want to talk a little bit about details here in New Mexico, since you and Justin have been working together specifically to push, and Senator Ivy Soto, and you've worked with Representative Gail Chasey. So here in New Mexico, just to give listeners a little bit of overview, according to Human Rights Watch, the imprisonment rate for Latinos in New Mexico is more than twice that for whites. White people are incarcerated about 208 people per 100,000. Latinos is double that. But for Black New Mexicans, the imprisonment rate is a staggering 6.4 times the rate for whites. In other words, although the state's population is only about 2% Black, about 6.5% of its disenfranchised voters are Black. That's a huge jump. So, and at this point, as of 2017, 24,000 New Mexicos were not eligible to vote due to felony convictions. So a huge percentage of those people were Black voters. And in New Mexico, anyone with a felony conviction needs to finish their parole before they can have their right to vote restored. But that's not easy. Even though that law is there, it's not easy to restore that right. Kelly, can you tell us about the challenges people with felony convictions face when they're trying to restore their voting rights?
Yes. As for myself, I had those challenges. And what I had to do was, like, when I got out of prison, I went to the clerk's office, and they said that they would get back to me. When they got back to me, had a letter that said, well, you need your discharge papers. And I gave them my discharge papers, and they still said I couldn't vote. It took me like 3 years to get my voting rights back. And it was very challenging, even though I did final out my parole, my probation, I finaled everything on that number, and they still wouldn't let me vote. But it's very important that people that are incarcerated or even on probation, parole, that they do have their voting rights restored, because, like, no matter where you're at, you're still considered a human being, and your voice is very important. You know, and voting is an extension of your voice. And it's very important to, you know, you want these conversations to change with people that are impacted by the system. And it'll change the conversation if you allow them to engage in civil engagement. And because I know being able to participate in civil engagement, that changed my whole world. My whole world, it changed. And And like now that I can participate in what's going on around me, because voting is important, because we're putting people in these offices to make these important decisions for us. So that's a major role in like civil engagement, is that we put these people in these offices to make these important decisions for us. And I'm speaking for women that are incarcerated, like inside the prison system, and not just because women have had a suffrage forever. We've always had to like fight for since the 1800s, like they have been fighting for voting rights, like women. And like now that women are able to vote, like it's very important that people that not are just women in general that know the importance of voting, because you can get somebody from just off the street and ask them, do you vote? And most likely a lot of women don't vote.
Why do you think that is?
Because like women have always had suffrage, and as far as when it comes to voting, and now that women are starting to step up, I believe that if we can get people need to get educated about voting and how important it is to vote, and then people that have been impacted by the system, they have always been told, well, you can't vote anyway, so. And this has been installed in them. And I believe if we would give people their voting rights back that have been impacted by the system, even when they're out on probation and parole, like, you know, they're not incarcerated anymore. They should be able to give their, you know, let their voice be heard, because they are, you know, coming back into these communities, and we want them to be productive members of society. And what better way to start engaging in your community and is to have your voice be heard and to be able to vote.
Mm-hmm. And Justin, you faced some challenges yourself when you tried to recoup your right to vote. What happened, Justin?
It took me a couple of years to get my rights restored. I had a certificate of discharge from New Mexico Corrections and a letter from the judge, but there was conflicting information on the county clerk's computer. It literally took a standoff in the county clerk's office. Millions for Prisoners organizer Selena Guerrero stood with me, and we began filming and bringing attention to what they were doing. And it took about 2 hours, but we got my voting rights restored that day in the form of a protest in the county clerk's office. The primary was the first time I've ever voted in my life. And it meant a lot to me. What Kelly was talking about civic engagement, that's, I believe, the key to reducing recidivism. Every time I got out of prison or jail, I found myself going back, repeating the same mistakes that put me there. I got engaged with Millions for Prisoners in Mexico and started participating and learning about politics. And, it gave me a purpose. It gave me a sense of purpose. And I found the value in my voice. Mm. Years of incarceration conditions people to kind of just go along. I mean, kind of renders us silent. I mean, it reinforces, disenfranchisement reinforces that
yeah.
silence that prison kind of, it's not helpful to anybody to have to believe in believing that they don't matter, what they say doesn't matter.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, but we're going to get right back into this. If you want to join the conversation about voter suppression, give us a call, 277-5866.
If KUNM strikes a special chord with you, donate that old accord to keep the tunes coming. Turn your Beetle into the Beatles. Turn your Altima into the ultimate in great music. Have a Buick Century from the last century, donate it to us in this century. We accept just about anything with wheels and an engine. To find out if your car qualifies, call 888-KUNM-CAR. It just takes a few minutes. That's 888-KUNM-CAR or 888-586-6227.
Native ceremony is an important part of our tribal nations. National health officials recommend tribal leaders consider canceling or postponing them until the pandemic is contained. Join us as we talk with spiritual leaders about the difficult choices around ceremonies. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Yasmin Khan. We've heard this hour some history of the voter suppression in the U.S. and New Mexico. Do you have a felony conviction and want to understand how to get your voting rights back after you finish probation or parole? Give us a call, 277-5866. We're here talking with Kelly Garcia Chavez, a voting rights advocate with the ACLU New Mexico, Justin Allen, a UNM undergraduate and an intern at America Votes, Democratic Senator Daniel Ivy Soto, executive director for county clerks and former state elections director. So, Justin and Kelly, you've done some work, quite a bit of work, with Representative Gail Chasey, who sponsored House Bill 57 to eliminate the ban on voting rights for felons and streamline the process of re-registering to vote. And you both have just talked about, even though you have the right to regain your civic right to vote, it was super difficult for you. It took years. So I talked with Representative Chasey by phone, and she said the ultimate goal is to allow people in prison to keep their voting rights, which is, you know, two states in the U.S. do that, but most don't. But this is a huge political challenge. Several civil rights groups, including the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, supported House Bill 57, but it still died. I wanted to ask Senator Daniel Ivy Soto, why is it such a challenge to push for voting rights for people with felony convictions?
You know, it's difficult for people to separate out because voting is really so sacred. For people to separate out the fact that it's a right, and we want to instead accord the ability to vote as a privilege. And even while we say it's a right, we treat it as if it were a privilege. And so that's the reason why is whether or not somebody is worthy of voting, and what the Constitution of the United States says really is that if you were born in this country, it is your right to vote. And you know, it's interesting, although the U.S. Constitution doesn't tie voting to citizenship, every state constitution does, including New Mexico. If the criteria for voting is citizenship, people who get sent to prison are still citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, the place of integrity, if we're going to tie it to citizenship, is to keep it tied to citizenship, and which is where Representative Chasey is trying to move the state. It's going to be a multi-step process to get there. But like I said, part of the problem is we say it's a right, but most people really want to distribute it as if it were a privilege.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I want to take a call with Bill from Los Lunas. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
There's a party that says it's a privilege. The other party says it's a right. You decide by your vote. Now, if there's discrimination, then there's an agenda. Now you got to educate yourself. What's the agenda? Does it serve you as your voter, or does it not? If it does not, you destroy it. If it serves you, you make it grow. Transparently, you make it grow. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for that. I want to thank Senator Daniel Ivy Soto for joining us today. Thank you so much for your insight.
My pleasure.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome Eileen Shendo, member of Jemez and Coche de Pueblos and manager of her father's campaign, State Senator Benny Shendo. Eileen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Eileen, felon voter laws make a huge impact in Native American communities because of how criminal offenses are counted there versus on non-tribal land. For example, a crime that's a misdemeanor on non-tribal land could be counted as a felony on tribal land. How does this affect voting for Native American communities?
Well, first, just in line with a lot of other numbers and statistics that were given, especially thanks to Justin's research, you know that large, almost, you could even say half to more than our population's voice is silenced. When Native Americans are literally institutionally being discriminated on and subjected to higher crimes and penalties for that, we lose that right inherently by just being who we are. And I think that is really important for Native Americans to remember, just in not only in their upbringing, but as we're looking to come to be certain positions in leadership, and especially upon our state and even in our own tribes, the, I guess you could say, number of different layers of influence us to have us silenced. And not only, and I think I mentioned this in a previous time, the jail system and the privatization of it is our current day slavery. And the people that are being subjected to these numbers are people of color. And if you look at the history of the United States from its earliest inception of creating its constitution, it was mirrored by the Iroquois Confederate people, their laws, their peace, their law of peace, basically, which outlined the way that their democratic process would outline. And the biggest thing that they left out in terms of the forefathers of America was that the women's approach to be part of that leadership and voting in the sense of their own influence to the different decisions that their own leaders would make. That one piece that got left out is your basis, the white supremacy that started at the inception of this country. It left out Native women purposely because of how we took care of our lands, the human nature of people, and protected what we all heard is this is our human right. It's our voice. It's our only passage to talk about our stories. And since that beginning, Native women have been discriminated on. The women's suffrage movement has never stopped for us. And I think it's very important for New Mexicans, especially Native Indigenous New Mexican women, to remember this is our right. No matter the laws that come into play, they perpetuate racism and systematic oppression. And we need, like the other men just spoke up, to find the right means, the values that protect all of us here in New Mexico, and keep those rights at our side, meaning at every moment when we're educating our young people to go into the polls in November, we take our families, we take ourselves. And even for those who have been neglected of that right because of a personal choice, as a young woman spoke, a lot of the people, and these are our brown people in the United States, haven't even been given the education or the tools to make such conscientious decisions, yet we penalize them and we throw them away. Mm-hmm. And then we allow them to sit there without that voice for almost a whole lifetime, if it could be for some people.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's been happening in New Mexico since U.S. became who it is. And I think it's just time that we acknowledge these conversations on a larger platform. And you do have to invite the woman voice in, and women, we have to begin to vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to to get back to Kelly on her voting with the importance of women. But first, I'd like to take one call from Peter Kubra in Albuquerque. Peter, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for covering this issue and for the work you do on this program. And I want to thank our state legislators for what they're doing, trying to ensure that people who have been in trouble with the law are not deprived of their citizenship effectively. And I would just like to say that I've been working on behalf of the people in our prison system since 1984 as a lawyer. And it is perfectly clear to me that there is a classism that's at the bottom of what we're doing here in New Mexico, and it's high time that we change it. I want to suggest that everybody, while they are incarcerated, ought to be able to vote as well as after their incarceration, because by and large, people are only in prison because they're poor, and people who are not poor almost never end up with felony convictions in New Mexico. I wonder if Mr. Ivy Soto has any thoughts about whether people ought to be able to vote while they're incarcerated as well as after their incarceration.
Yeah, Senator Ivy Soto isn't on the line anymore, but I do know that that is the, as Representative Gail Chasey mentioned when I spoke to her on the phone, she said the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is not taking away people's right to vote at all when they're imprisoned. And I'd like to go back and have Kelly and Justin. Kelly, you said that although HB 57... It died in the House, but what laws do exist for, what does it say that felons have the right to when they are finished? What exactly is the structure that people who have felony convictions have to live under right now?
What they have to live under is, you know, they're still denied their voting rights until they go to the clerk's office and they have to prove all this. You've got to take your discharge papers. And like now, like, I don't know how it is now, but I know people are still having problems because they have that glitch in their office that they don't know if, you know, their system isn't connected with the Department of Corrections. And so you have to show the discharge papers, sometimes even get a letter from the judge, because I had to get a letter from the judge with my discharge papers from the parole board and from the judge, mm-hmm. saying that I didn't, that my voting rights could be restored. And
HB 57, correct me if I'm wrong, but that bill was supposed to have registration be automatic upon release from prison, right?
Yes.
So that would have been the streamlining, and it would have helped people not take years and years to get their voting rights back, which is kind of ridiculous because the law says you can have them back here after you finish parole. But I guess HB 57 was also saying that once people are just out of prison, that they don't have to finish their parole before they get their voting rights back. Is that correct?
Yes. And the goal then was, you know, for everybody to get, you know, when the bill first started, it was everybody gets to vote, even inside prison. But it died in the Senate, actually. It died on the Senate floor because it went through the House, it got amended, and even with the amendments, it stopped in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, as I want to go back to what Peter mentioned. First of all, it's those of us who've watched, you know, 13th or know a little bit about the prison system. The majority of people in prison are people who may not have even committed a crime, and they're being depoliticized, having this essential right removed. But whether you see the flaws in the prison system or not, most people in New Mexico, about 95% of people, are ultimately released. And gaining this civil right of being able to vote is an important step to reintegrating into their community. And there's tons of academic research published in the American Sociological Review, among other outlets, that shows that former offenders who vote are less likely to be rearrested, and it keeps people out of prison. It lowers costs for taxpayers, and it helps people really reintegrate into their jobs, into their society. Justin, you mentioned the benefits of getting back people's right to vote. What are the benefits that you've seen from people regaining the right to vote? And how did you feel when you regained your right to vote?
Okay. First off, felon disenfranchisement has nothing to do with justice. It is a tool of punishment and subjugation. I mean, before I got my voting rights restored, I never cared about politics. I would always, I never imagined that I would be at the table talking with senators or legislators about voting rights. What it's done for me personally is it's given me the opportunity to reestablish my place and voice in society. I've been given the opportunity to assert my voice and find value in it after years of being silenced. I just want to reiterate that most people that end up in prison lost their voice way before they ended up there. Mm-hmm. And so these systems that reinforced that silence is perpetual punishment. I mean, mm-hmm. that's why we have such a high recidivism rate. People don't believe some people don't even have the ability to articulate the things that are happening to them because their voice has been taken. You know, it's taken college education and 5 years being out of prison for me to finally have confidence in myself. And I imagine that's true for a lot of formerly incarcerated people. The barriers that we go through just with probation or parole.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Justin.
Overwhelming.
I'm going to have to cut you out there, but I want to remind people that absentee voting begins in New Mexico on October 6th. We have to get information about how to get a ballot and how to register to vote on our website at KUNM.org. That's all the time we have for today. Many thanks to our guests, Eileen Shendo, Finney Coleman, Justin Allen, Kelly Garcia Chavez, and Senator Daniel Ivy Soto. Also, thanks to Kale Chasey for background on this issue. And thank you to everyone who called or sent comments.